This week on the Edible Valley Podcast, we welcome Miles Olson, author of Unlearn Rewild, Earth Skills, Ideas, and Inspiration for the Future Primitive.
Welcome to the Edible Valley Podcast. I'm Blaine Prost.
And we would like you to join with us on our ongoing adventure exploring our Edible Valley. I am Jonathan Fraser.
I'd like to welcome to the Edible Valley studio, Miles Olson, local author and feralist. Welcome, Miles.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you're kind of living off the land and foraging, and I've read your book, and I'm very interested in this whole concept. So give us a little bit of feedback of what you're doing.
So I've been living in the Comox Valley for my whole life, pretty much. And for the last 10 years, I've been living kind of on the fringe of the town here, of the urban sprawl, for most of that as a squatter and learning how to live as close to the land as I can, foraging, hunting, gardening, scavenging, dumpster diving, picking up roadkill. Mm-hmm. All sorts of just a mishmash of different things that that can allow me to exist in a relatively free way.
So you're going on looking for the things that this valley has to offer with your foraging and exploring sort of the areas of this area.
Yeah. Comox Valley. Yeah, in kind of an opportunistic way, I suppose. Yeah.
Right. Excellent. So yeah, now you're living just outside of town right now?
Yeah, I live right on the edge of Courtney, pretty much.
And so you spend most of your time here sort of exploring our wilderness areas. Is that it? Or are you sort of everywhere?
I kind of dance in between both worlds pretty much. Kind of, I live right on the edge and live on an acreage that's probably around 70 acres of forested land. And then so I spend a lot of time there. I spend a lot of time cruising around the more populated areas, and I cruise around the less populated areas. Yeah, just kind of feed off of everything that the area has to offer.
That's excellent.
So you're getting into a good time of year, I guess, for foraging for food.
Yeah, I had my first salmon berries a couple days ago.
Oh, wow.
And, lots of shoots and leaves, and lots of rain to make everything lush. And there's lots of food and oyster mushrooms out there right now. It's pretty exciting.
Yeah, I like the oyster mushrooms. Mm-hmm. That was a score that I found last weekend. I found a bunch of them.
But let's go on to talk about your book. Where did the idea of writing a book about your life, I guess? Is that sort of what that boils down to and what you've learned?
Yeah, I think that the book, basically as a teenager, I decided that I didn't want to live on the given terms of modern society or whatever. I wanted to live as wild and free as I could, an idealistic, youthful kind of dream. And the last 10 years, basically, since I got out of high school, has been spent trying to put that into practice as good as possible. But it's been a really clumsy and ridiculous journey, I would say. And I didn't have any teachers or guidance or kind of any elders or cultural institutions that really could help me and my friends along as we went. We were just a bunch of clueless suburban youth making mistakes and getting ourselves hungry and sick and cold and wet. Mm-hmm. So this book is, it's in some ways a kind of an inspirational manual for disenchanted youth, maybe. I was writing it in a sense to a younger self.
Right.
It's a younger version of myself.
Sure.
As a toolkit for, hey, you know what? You're not crazy. You might be onto something. And there's a whole other way of experiencing life out there. And there's whole other avenues that you can go down that aren't being talked about.
What are some of those lessons you learned? Is these lessons you learned the hard way? Is that?
Yeah. Oh, geez. I mean, we didn't know how to build fires. We didn't know how to split wood. We didn't know that you were supposed to dry wood before you tried to burn it. We didn't, you know, that led to that lack of knowledge right there led to a winter of not having fires because we just couldn't understand, you know. We chopped the wood up, we, you know, had newspaper, we lit it on fire, this is supposed to ignite, but now it just smolders and smokes. So something like that, which doesn't sound like an enormous piece of knowledge, it creates a lot of suffering to learn it on your own. Yeah, and just countless things of that nature.
Excellent. Okay. So how long have you been sort of on your own in this experiment? Or I shouldn't say experiment.
No, that's fair to call an experiment. Okay. how long? Well, I've been squatting in one specific place for the last 6 years, and there with a group of friends 6 years ago, we started by building a big communal cabin that we shared together, and then we started building satellite cabins, and then that was a very kind of intense and fruitful communal land project that ended maybe a year and a half ago. So, and that's when I started writing my book. And for the year and a half since, I've kind of been the solitary hermit writer living in the woods.
Right.
Yeah.
So maybe you can go through some of the foods that you've found throughout the Comox Valley and living.
Sure. Well, the book is called Unlearn, Rewild, and the whole, it's not specifically about food, but a lot of the philosophy and the skills that it goes into are totally about food. The way that it relates to food would be, I guess, when I first started deciding that I wanted to live in a way that wasn't killing the planet and that was healthy and that was sane, that was alternative, I kind of did what everyone does. I became a vegetarian, mm-hmm. and then I became a vegan, and I rode a bike, and I dumpster dived. Not everybody does that, but just ways of limiting your consumption and being greener. And over time, me and the community that I was around started realizing that there was some flaws in our initial philosophy, which was kind of veganism. And part of that was that we kind of latched onto this idea that where our culture has really stepped out of alignment with the natural world is that humans, unlike everything else on the planet, they don't just exist with the world as it is. They take it and modify it, and they take wild nature. Humans don't exist in a wild state. Everything else mm-hmm. exists in a wild state. We live in a completely man-made environment. A lot of people don't actually experience anything that isn't man-made in their day-to-day life because they're mm-hmm. always plugged into their iPhone or Facebook or on their cell phone or in the car or sleeping with their partner or whatever. It's all filtered through human. Whereas everything else in the world exists in this diverse kind of organic wild realm, and that relates to food because we were all eating a vegetarian diet, and we realized it kind of dawned on me once when I was at a talk being given by this farmer on Salt Spring who was growing soybeans, which was kind of really exciting for someone on Salt Spring to be growing their own like sustainable plant protein,
right?
And so I was really excited. And during his talk, he was talking about the main problem was these deer kept on getting into his field where he was growing all the soybeans.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, destroying his soybean crop. And I remember realizing, wait a minute. I think you're getting a sign here. and in a not so subtle way, he was, you know, a protein source that was already existing, you know, in wild nature without humans going in there and meddling mm-hmm. with their minds and their hands, was just hopping into his field and kind of presenting itself to him. And that's where the whole concept of rewilding and food kind of come together. Our culture is based on taking wild nature and twisting it and domesticating it, and we do that with our food, obviously. We mm-hmm. have domesticated crops. We farm, garden. Those things are not the most ugliest aspects of our culture. But they are that pattern of oppression and domestication. And so for us, the whole experiment has been, can we live without that? Can we live without having an oppressive and manipulative relationship with the land? And I can't say yes or no to that. That's it is an experiment, yeah, but right. That's kind of what motivated and motivates me in this whole journey.
Right. Hmm. So making that connection and finding the sustainability in it all.
Yeah, and trying to, as opposed to just finding sustainability with food, finding a healthy relationship with food. You know, to think about it, we usually think of relationships just between humans. To have a sustainable relationship with another person is not necessarily a glowing review, right? Like, how are things with you and your husband? Oh, they're sustainable. it's not top notch, you know.
Yeah.
And I think where I choose to aim is how are things with your husband? They're amazing. We're right. So in love. It's ecstatic, and we're actually having it's mutually beneficial, and we're both getting so much out of it and giving so much. Yeah,
because in my definition of sustainable, it's you're actually taking, or you're giving back more than you're taking. Mm-hmm. It's like a permaculture sort of, I'm studying permaculture right now, so it's sort of the principle is you can take some, but you got to put back more than you take. So you're improving things versus always taking away from the earth, basically.
Yeah, totally. So,
and that's kind of what your approach is like, because you're pulling from the land, but you're putting back surpluses and.
Yeah, totally. It's to not be conscious of how you're affecting that community and trying to enhance it. If it's a plant community, for instance, the Comox Valley, I think that the Comox Valley used to essentially just be a giant hazelnut orchard.
Oh, really?
By the looks of it. Yeah. If I noted that a big chunk of Comox actually was literally hazelnut orchard.
Oh, wow.
And now right by the Philberg Park.
Yeah.
And now it's all suburbs, but you can still see hazelnut trees in every third yard or whatever.
Oh, wow.
And same within Courtney. I'm kind of outing this, so everyone is going to know where to find hazelnuts. But yeah, the valley is super rich with hazelnuts. And me and the community that I was living with, and still every fall, we go down and descend into the valley and just harvest tons and tons of hazelnuts, sacks.
Yeah.
And it's pretty significant. Local ethical food for us to be able to just go and pick up underneath trees.
Yeah.
But I, you know, it dawned on all of us after a few years of this is, hey, where are the trees that are going to follow these ones coming from?
Right.
You know, if we're not planting them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've kind of made a pact with myself to every year just plant some seeds in the ground around my house, and they sprout up, and then I can spread them out in the woods around my house, or take them to town, or give them to people to plant in their yards.
Mm.
That's a great
but
idea.
If everybody did that with not, you know, just with some food, with apple trees or pear trees, whatever you harvest, whatever you like, if everybody planted one tree a year, you know, if 10% of them survived, then all of a sudden we'd be in that reciprocal relationship.
Yeah.
Which is pretty awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. I know I just took my front yard apart and, planted a basically a food forest of perennial stuff, so
nice.
Mixed with annuals, and it's almost chaotic, but not quite. It's kind of exciting to watch everything. So in a few years when it fills in and everything grows up, it should be pretty neat.
Cool.
So it was pretty liberating to cover the lawn in cardboard and just get rid of it all.
Yeah.
Oh, we used to always have a game we play when we're picking berries or blackberries or raspberries or whatever, but always throw one back in the bush. And
nice.
Be like, hey, we're giving one back at least, right?
Yeah.
Hopefully we'll get another bush for next year.
Yeah. So what about protein sources? Do you fish, animals, shellfish?
All of the above.
Because you started out vegan?
Yeah, I mean, I was never that good of a vegan because I always was really poor. And the two don't necessarily go together that well. Right? I remember being, just staying at a friend's, laying on the floor and just being so hungry. And they had a thing of hot dogs and them just like, come on, you know you want it. And just being so hungry that you got to eat.
Right.
But yeah, I guess I reconciled that. Yeah, realizing that. To harvest animal protein yourself in an intimate and mature and connected and respectful ethical way is something that is really beautiful and healthy and getting beans and rice that come from whoever knows where.
Mm-hmm.
Someone that eats that food, that's beautiful and healthy too. You know, there's nothing that I can, you know, I don't want to make anyone feel bad about whatever they eat. Yeah. But if you're that disconnected from your food source, you don't get to talk to people who harvest their own deer and fish. You don't get to, you know, that's not how it works. But locally harvest lots of salmon in the fall, deer, rabbits, oysters. The things that are abundant and easy to harvest in the area.
Are there lots of rabbits around?
They're non-native. Their populations fluctuate a lot.
Right.
And so for a few months, every couple of years, there will be a population boom.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and you're rubbing your hands together.
Yeah, they're okay. Deer are better.
Yeah.
They're more predictable.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, deer meat's pretty amazing.
We had a couple of roasts the other day. We barbecued up.
Yeah, backstrap. My last piece of backstrap from last year.
Yeah. I think transitioning from a vegetarian and vegan ideal, the first step was roadkill.
Yeah.
For me and my friends, which was a pretty easy kind of transition ethically.
Right. Because you didn't have to kill.
Yeah. I still love picking up roadkill because I don't, you know, even though I've been hunting for years now.
Yeah.
I love picking up roadkill. I don't, you know, I still feel that loss and that, you know, the gravity of taking a life is still real.
Mm-hmm.
So roadkill is fantastic for that.
Yeah, well, you're utilizing a otherwise garbage resource, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and its death was, you know, kind of a tragedy.
Yeah.
And you're honoring it by
consuming it.
Yeah.
How are you preserving food? I mean, I don't imagine you have refrigeration or freezers or.
No. In the winter, it's obviously cold. So outside is kind of like refrigeration or freezer, depending on the winter.
Mm-hmm.
But that has been a lot of fun. And it was a big mystery, especially with meat. Because we're told often how if you have meat and you leave it on the counter for overnight, then don't eat it, it'll kill you.
Right.
Which has not been my experience.
Yeah.
Firstly, picking up roadkill in the first place is kind of goes against that orthodoxy.
Sure, yeah.
But preserving a lot of just hanging meat outside for it to age for up to a month or more.
Mm-hmm.
And then drying, just slicing it thin and hanging it on strings, either in the sun or above the wood stove in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the main preservation methods. I've experimented with burying meat and fermenting it and curing it, but my favorites are just plain old dried or aged.
Yeah. So when you age it, does it have a shelf life? Still, like, will it stay indefinite or is it got a shelf life?
It's a process of, it's kind of like making sauerkraut, I guess, because the enzymes present in the meat start to pre-digest it, just like bacteria when you're making yogurt or sauerkraut or cheese, they start to pre-digest it. And so they are breaking the protein down. They're making it more tender, so it's nice and soft and more digestible.
Right.
But depending on the temperature, if it's 30 Celsius out, then a deer leg, after a few days, will start to be quite tenderized and after a week it will be, you know, really starting to age in a significant way. And it's all just a matter of taste at that point. As far as pathogenic bacteria, those grow. The reason there's such a hysteria around it with meat is because we usually wrap our meat in plastic.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And if you don't do that and you just leave it open to oxygen, it's just a natural process that could continue until it falls off the bone.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, I guess it's the moisture that traps the bacteria and that you don't want.
Yeah. So it's a fun process to experiment with. Mm-hmm. Our food that we grew up eating in North America is so kind of uncultured. It's so bland and kind of predictable, and so for me and my friends, learning how to do all of these preservation techniques without electricity has been a lot of fun, because a lot of them are kind of biological culture fermentation processes.
Traditional too.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, those are skills that I think as a society we need to start bringing back, versus relying on the just-in-time grocery stores and all our food not being irradiated and things to kill off pathogens. And we need those healthy bacteria in our guts and on our bodies and in our bodies. And so many of that stuff is just disappearing.
Yeah, definitely.
It keeps us from getting sick and allergies. And that's what we talked about with our guest last week, Don Wilson, and we were talking about fermenting and pathogens and things like that. Something I've been doing quite a bit of. I eat a lot of fermented stuff, and I've noticed a real improvement in my health since I've been doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty fantastic. And we miss out on a lot, I'm not sure if we is the appropriate term, but the dominant culture misses out on a lot by eating all the pasteurized processed foods.
Yeah. They don't even ever, a lot of people don't even ever touch the dirt with their hands or their feet either, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a shame.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I've had a healthy recompensation of that in my adult life.
Well, I think a lot of us have it's coming just a disconnect with their food. I work with it all day long, and a lot of times I don't realize, or I don't know where it's coming from or how I'm getting it. So it's kind of neat to be in that position where you're getting everything fresh right from the land.
Yeah. And my lifestyle varies. I know this winter I was eating largely just deer and food that was locally obtained. And right now I've been writing a lot and focusing on different things. So all my greens and stuff are coming from the land, but other food is coming from the store and stuff. So it ebbs and flows with me a lot. One of the things that I have kind of tried to emphasize a lot in my book and when I'm teaching these skills at workshops and stuff is, for me, I think the most exciting thing about all of this stuff is, like you were talking about, just having, reconnecting and having that relationship and having that intimacy with our food and with the land and with just the beauty of nature, and really integrating that into ourselves and our lives. Mm-hmm. As more than just a survivalist kind of, there's all of these other logistical reasons why, we need to have local food, because the food system is crazy. We're at the end of this weird supply chain where our food comes from the desert of California or China or what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
And those are all good reasons to move someone towards connecting with their local foods. But I think really the most important reason, and the only really important reason, is to heal that relationship, and to kind of enter into a relationship with the land.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely important.
Yeah.
And gain some respect for your food too.
Yeah. Yeah, there's something very humbling, especially about killing something and eating it. Mm-hmm. Really is a deeply kind of humbling and quieting experience.
It is, yeah. Yeah, it really makes you reflect, and it makes you appreciate what you are able to obtain.
Mm-hmm.
And that you're able to nourish your body and not just buy an awful looking chicken breast in the store that's wrapped in plastic and styrofoam that doesn't look like it even came from an animal, because there's no skin on it, there's nothing. It's just like, it doesn't almost look real. Like it could have been created in a laboratory.
Yeah.
So And I think the grocery store product's getting more and more like that, where it's getting, there's less identification of what the actual piece is.
Mm-hmm.
People don't, they don't want bones in their meat and skin on their meat. I just think that's so bizarre.
Yeah, I went through a period when I was probably 18 or 19 when I couldn't actually go into a grocery store and get anything.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't, I was working for a month in Vancouver and sleeping on a friend's floor, and I needed to eat because I was working 12 hours a day on a farm, and
mm-hmm.
I would go into the grocery store, and I had spent a lot of time in the forest for the last year or two before that, and going into the grocery store, I'd walk up and down the aisles, and I would see those chicken breasts you talk about, and just mm-hmm. Apples covered in wax, and just all of the food just looked like this dystopian nightmare to me, and I couldn't, I just couldn't get anything, and my friend that I was staying with, he's like, you have an eating disorder. and when I reflect on it now, I did have an eating disorder, because we all need to eat just to be healthy. Even, you know, it's good to acknowledge that tragedy that is the industrial food system. And it's another thing to do something positive and move towards positive solutions.
Mm-hmm.
But at that point, totally devastating my health.
Yeah, avoiding it and getting sick, not winning. Yeah.
So I wouldn't mind you telling us a little bit about the workshops you're doing.
Well, I'm doing workshops locally on a whole variety of kind of earth skills is what I call them, but just traditional living skills or skills that have something to do with connecting to the land. So I'm teaching courses on wild edible and medicinal plants and herbal medicine making and willow basketry and some workshops on hide tanning probably coming up. And a whole variety of skills, some of which are touched on in the book. I think there's an appetite that's growing for all of this kind of know-how. And mm-hmm. And yeah, it's just a lot of fun for people to connect and get together and learn this stuff and share.
So where are you doing the workshops?
I do them. I've done a couple at my place, which is a squat. Right. And that's got its limitations.
Right. Yeah.
But generally, I do them at different parks and locations around the valley.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So if someone wanted to do one, how would they find it?
You can go to my website, milesolson.net.
Okay.
Or just Google my name, Miles Olson, and there's information there. You can get in touch with me if you're interested.
Okay, cool. If anyone's interested in any of those things, that's a great way to learn.
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting back to Earth.
Yeah, I'm very interested in learning some of this stuff for sure.
What kind of, we're talking about medicines, herbal medicines mm-hmm. and stuff like that. What can you tell us about that?
Well, that's a fairly broad subject.
I know, it's a bit of a broad.
But another area that myself and the community that I was learning a lot of these skills with for years delved fairly deeply into. For, you know, the same reason of connecting to land and also not depending on pharmaceuticals and if we hurt ourselves, not having to go to the clinic or the hospital. You know, there's a section on my book about natural methods of birth control. That was an area that at least the women that I was living with spent a lot of time studying and employing for themselves, which is an amazing kind of, if to kind of juxtapose modern birth control versus natural plant-based and body awareness-based birth control.
Mm-hmm.
The two, like, that's kind of the perfect over-dramatization of how beautiful natural healthcare can be and how bizarre and destructive pharmaceutical can be, because I wouldn't look down on anyone for using pharmaceutical birth control, but it does have all of these side effects. It causes bone loss. My girlfriend, when I was a teenager, started getting cavities because she was taking birth control, and it causes loss of interest. It causes mood swings and depression, and it can cause blood clots in the brain. I know a woman who had a blood clot in her brain and had to have it like removed because of taking the birth control pill.
Yeah.
And something as simple as tuning into the rhythms of your cycle and knowing a few fairly safe herbs and their administration can make that insane risk that you put your body through obsolete.
Really? Yeah.
That's just one thing, and there's so many different plants and so many different ailments that they're amazing for treating, that it's well worth getting acquainted with.
So this is, I guess it was sort of an experiment for you, but like, where did you find your information from this? Was it like studying a little trial and error?
Lots of trial and error and ridiculous amounts, really, on some things that I remember, just trying to learn how to make a bow or something, and it taking so much work and effort to learn very basic concepts that had I had access to someone who was who had that skill, I would have just fast forwarded it months. But yeah, people, word of mouth, books, researching online. The biggest catalyst for learning probably was having a community of people around me who were all equally obsessed with learning these skills. That just supercharged all of us, and everyone's experimentation would feed each other. So yeah, and that's I do feel that our communal squat and that whole experience was a pretty unique experience, and out of it blossomed some knowledge and skills and information and lifestyle stuff that is fairly unique. And that's part of why I wrote the book, was to like offer that up for other people.
Yeah, it was a great read. I enjoyed it immensely. I grew up reading like Tom Brown's Wilderness Survival books and things like that. So in My Side of the Mountain was my favorite book growing up. So that kind of stuff's always been in my head, and living the way you're living has been a fantasy of mine, but I'm in this cycle of,
Yeah, you've got a Forest Gardens planted in your front yard.
I'm trying to break it down as best I can. I'm going to bring a forest into my little plot. But yeah, no, it's... So speaking of the trial and error, how long did it take you the first time you tried to make a friction fire?
Well, I didn't get it the first time, that's for sure.
Yeah.
that's probably actually a pretty good example of how long something can take without the proper guidance or technique. The key to friction fire is all technique. It's kind of like splitting wood or something. Anyone who has split much wood knows that it's not brute force.
Yeah.
It's just how you swing the axe and just kind of the zen of it, dude. Going to that right spot where you know the grain is going to split apart and just pops apart. If you keep on hitting it where there's a knot, it doesn't matter how much brute force you use. Your technique is wrong.
That's right.
You're not studying it properly.
You're just wearing yourself out. It's the second time you warmed yourself with that piece of wood.
and a lot of these probably everything is like that, really, right? But definitely all of these earth-based skills are very much like that. They're all incredibly simple.
Mm-hmm.
They're things that we've done with little or no technology, really, for thousands and thousands of years. But unless you know that technique, which is sometimes more complex than just aiming away from the knot. But with friction fire specifically, it took me, maybe months or years.
Yeah, wow.
And eventually I was lucky enough to meet people who had mastered it fully themselves, and they showed me a few little techniques of, you hold it this way and you keep on, you have to use these specific woods, this wood on that wood, and...
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very specific what you need to do for it to be effective. Mm-hmm. The wood has to be incredibly dry.
Mm-hmm. You need
to have the right tinder once you get a coal. It's quite easy. If you've got all that, you could give someone, if you have prepared all the materials and show someone, they'll get it in a half hour. But
yeah, when you're learning from scratch. Yeah. I guess you didn't have TV to watch Survivor Man either to learn. To watch what he was doing.
No, I haven't never even seen that, but yeah. He probably has a whole show to show you how.
Yeah, kind of does all that stuff, but
yeah,
makes it look easy on TV, of course.
Yeah.
Well, Got anything else to, I guess we should tell people where they can find your book.
My book, you can buy it locally at our local bookstores at the Village Muse up in Cumberland or Laughing Oyster. I know they both carry it. Mm-hmm. You can also get it on Amazon, or if you see me biking around, you stop me and get a copy off me. It's called Unlearn Rewild. And I also teach workshops locally. If you're interested, just check out my website, milesolson.net.
Good.
Yeah, so definitely a good read, for sure.
Cool. All right, Miles. Well, thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Great to meet you.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
All right, thanks for listening to the Edible Valley Podcast. We gratefully accept donations to help with the operating costs of the podcast or local ingredients to create new dishes in the Edible Valley Test Kitchen. Check out our website, ediblevalley.com. Like us on Facebook and follow our Twitter feed at Edible Valley. Email us with your comments or guests you would like to hear on the show. Don't hesitate to send along your cooking questions for John to answer on the show or to pick our brain on other local food information. EdibleValley@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and remember, keep it local.